remember things like that? That's the way it used to be in radio. You just couldn't do a thing without having the organist put an exclamation point on it for you. See what I mean? Radio has come a long way to reach the point of its 50th anniversary. It's been a long road paved by the sound effects men, the actors, the writers, directors, the musicians, and most certainly the great news events that kept millions of Americans glued to their receivers throughout the era of radio's golden years. This is where many of ABC's pages in the radio history books were written. Studio 1A. They don't build studios like this anymore. It's cavernous. Some of the secrets of sound still lurk here. See what I mean? A little imagination went a long way back in those old days. The audience never knew that you were standing before an RCA 44 mic, about 10 inches high, in a two-story room with special acoustical tile lining the walls and ceiling, and a half dozen men hard at work behind the glass of the control room. Now, Studio 1A reflects the changing times. The more than 1,200 affiliates of ABC Radio's four radio networks are primarily interested in carrying newscasts from the network. And Studio 1A is used as a storeroom for videotapes. The tan and white paint is fading. The light bulbs have grown dim with age. But with a little imagination... Oh, wait a minute now. What's a horse doing in here?
Oh, hi, Don.
Fred Foy.
Well, horses used to be a regular, you know, Don, when we were doing the Lone Ranger.
Fred Foy, the announcer on the Lone Ranger. Say, who was that masked man?
Who was that masked man? Well, that masked man for the years that I worked on the show was Brace Beamer. Although prior to him, the part was played by Earl Grauser in the beginning, and there were several Lone Rangers prior to Grauser, but Brace did the show for a period of, I would say, at least 20 or more years.
Now, how about Tonto, his Indian companion?
Well, Tonto was John Todd, who, believe it or not, was a little bald-headed Irishman, an ex-Shakespearean actor.
That show originated in Detroit, didn't it?
Right, out of WXYZ, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
I recall another famous program that came out of Detroit, Green Hornet.
The Green Hornet, yes, the Green Hornet, Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, was also out of Detroit.
Were you ever associated with that show?
Yes, for a while I did the narration on the Green Hornet, and also Sergeant Preston.
Did the Lone Ranger and the Green Hornet draw a lot of fan mail?
Oh, yes, yes, a great deal.
Did you find most of the requests were for silver bullets?
Oh, yes, lots of that. You know, silver bullets, and of course the many questions about could we get a picture of the Lone Ranger and see what he would look like without his mask. But this they never did.
When did the Lone Ranger go off radio?
September 3rd, 1954.
Dramatic shows and soap operas made up a vast part of the radio programming. Remember this?
Inner Sanctum Mystery.
You never knew who or what was lurking behind a door in the old days of radio. George Ansbrough, for instance, the famous announcer. Say, George, didn't you used to do Young Widder Brown?
I sure did, Don. I did it for quite a long time.
Do the actors and actresses on the soap operas really get involved into the lines that they were reading?
Oh, yes. They were gesticulating. Their hands were going all over the place and whatnot. And sometimes when they were supposed to strike another actor, even though he might be... 5 feet across the studio from him, because out would go a fist, and if he were 2 feet across, it would really catch him right on the chin.
Can you recall some of the unusual circumstances that happened during the presentation of soap operas?
If an actor was in need of a vacation, the writer of the script would conveniently have him go into a coma or some such thing as that, where he was just out for however many weeks his vacation was to last. Or if there was something about a performance of a certain actor on a soap opera that the powers that be didn't care about, rather than continue his services, they would write the script in such a fashion that he would die.
George, every afternoon at 4:15, do you miss picking up that script in a radio studio and saying, when last we saw young Winter Brown?
No, I miss every Thursday picking up the check.
Time now for young Winter Brown.
In Michael Forsythe's hotel room, Ellen Brown has spoken words which Michael has hoped she would speak ever since he fell in love with her months ago, after Dr. Anthony Loring believed a lie about her and discarded her and was tricked into marriage by his wife, Millicent. For Ellen has just said...
It was James Thurber who said, a soap opera is a kind of sandwich between thick slices of advertising. Spread 12 minutes of dialogue, add predicament, villainy, and female suffering in equal measure. Throw in a dash of nobility, sprinkle with organ music, cover with a rich announcer, and serve 5 times a week. That sounds pretty corny now, but the importance of radio as a communications medium was not built solely on corn.
See, guys!
By the time Europe was rumbling with the noises of madmen in the 1930s, network radio had come into its own. The National Broadcasting Company, first established in 1926, was operating 2 services, the Red Network and the Blue Network. The Blue Network later became ABC. The government forced a separation. CBS and Mutual had nationwide hookups, too. Radio had become established as an important link between the American home and the world outside.
It was riding majestically toward us like some great feather.
Herbert Morrison was at Lakehurst, New Jersey on May 7th, 1937, doing the kind of news coverage listeners have become accustomed to. His description of the Zeppelin Hindenburg arriving was being transcribed on a portable disc recorder for later broadcast.
Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh, my, get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between the this is terrible. This is the
other voices from the 30s saw broadcast journalism through its formative years.
This generation,
Franklin D. Roosevelt,
has a rendezvous with destiny.
I'll lift up to the door.
Clem McCarthy.
The count is down. The count is 5, 6, 7, 8. The men are in the ring.
The Duke of Windsor.
When I tell you that I have found it impossible to carry the heavy burden of responsibility without the help and support of the woman I love.
I consider myself
Lou Gehrig.
The luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Fantastic.
Neville Chamberlain.
Incredible it is that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing.
Good evening, everybody.
H.V. Kaldenborn.
Come to Washington to see the start of the new Congress.
Walter Winchell. If radio journalism was in its teen years in the 30s, then radio entertainment had entered its adulthood. Not all of the entertainment on radio in the 30s was highbrow. One program which began in the 20s continued into the 30s. The United States literally came to a halt every night when Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll became Amos and Andy.
Why can't they have a Democrat and a Republican president at the same time?
The trouble with that is the Republican would get everything messed up for the Democrat and vice versa.
And what?
vice versa.
He ain't running, is he?
Who ain't running?
Bryce Visser.
Americans welcome many personalities into their living rooms. Linger. Rudy Valley.
Longer in the twilight with me.
Somebody come along with a plan.
Will Rogers.
Plow under part of the cotton. And we did, and other nations like Brazil found out where we plowed it under, and they come and dug it up, and now they've got more cotton than we have.
Heaven.
Eddie Cantor.
Your chair and my chair. When you smile the way you do.
Ted Lewis.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, sir. Is everybody happy?
Kate Smith.
Over the mountain.
Radio brought a new degree of warmth to America's firesides when the chill of world events was being felt. President Roosevelt conducted fireside chats.
Today, as in these many years past, we continue this great crusade. Made possible not by a few large gifts, but by...
War was moving inexorably closer in the late 1930s.
I am speaking to you from the cabinet room at 10 Downing Street. This country is at war.
Some Americans felt that the U.S. should stay out of it, and radio listeners heard Charles Lindbergh speak to America First rally.
If we enter fighting for democracy abroad, we may enter...
On one fateful Sunday in 1941... Many Americans were listening to a football game.
Nice block there by Lehman. Tuff still going. He's up to the 25. And now he's hit and hit hard about the 27-yard line. Bruiser Kennard made the tackle.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. Stay tuned for further developments, which will be broadcast immediately as received.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Radio did its part in the war years. Armed Forces Radio brought a touch of home to the GIs in the field.
The Jack Benny Program.
And war correspondents brought action in the field into the homes of Americans.
Flak is coming up in the sky.
George Hicks going ashore at Normandy with the Allies on D-Day.
Something burning is falling down through the sky.
We interrupt this program to bring you this special news flash. The German news agency Transocean announced tonight that the Allied invasion had begun.
Tom O'Brien was a young announcer during those war years. Now he's vice president in charge of ABC Radio Network News. Tom, what do you recall of World War II in radio?
Well, Don, I can remember one thing. Early morning of June 6th, I certainly wasn't feeling very brilliant. I was the low man on the totem pole, and I happened to be standing by in the network newsroom when that first flash came over about the invasion of Europe. And in those days, newspapers took 2 or 3 hours to get out on the street. There was no television. The networks would flash the news, and the whole nation would listen. Radio then was the fastest means of getting the news across, as it is today. But during those war years, we had no competition at all.
Was the coverage of the news in World War II handled any differently than it is today?
I think it was far more formal in those days, Don. I remember that I went out to San Francisco and spent 3 months in San Francisco, and all I was sent out there to do was to say, we return you now to New York. I would go along on presidential assignments, and the only duty that a broadcaster had in those days was to say, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
We've had a very fast flying trip up to now, flew all the way down here from San Francisco.
Radio entertainers went overseas to see the boys. Bob Hope, even then, made a habit of broadcasting from war zones.
When we got about halfway down, the pilot turned around to me and said, are you a little nervous? I said, yeah, this is only my third time up. He said, you beat me, this is my first.
But smiles easily vanished in those days. There was little to smile at when you heard Edward R. Murrow.
This is London.
Howard K. Smith communicated the grim reality of war as he walked through the rubble of Berlin.
Generally speaking, the center of Berlin has been truly flattened. For block after block and mile after mile of avenues and streets, there's nothing but roofless, hollow hulls of houses. Out around the fringes of town, the houses with their roofs still on become more numerous.
In the Pacific, radio reported General MacArthur's return.
By the grace of Almighty God, our forces stand again on Philippine soil.
Radio brought news of a new force unleashed by science.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base.
Harry S. Truman.
We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans.
The American Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations bring you a special program. We take you directly to the battleship Missouri in Tokyo Bay.
Representatives.
With a stroke of a pen, enemies would become friends. The world would be at peace. And radio covered it all. There wasn't any TV then.
Whereby peace may be restored.
Radio could now concentrate on its own wars. The battles among the fictitious characters of Hop Harrigan, Captain Midnight, Superman, the Green Hornet, Tom Mix, Dick Tracy, and all the others. I think I detect the sound effects man at work. As a matter of fact, he looks like a sound effects man. He looks very much like Bob Prescott.
Thank you, Don.
Bob, what does the sound effects man do?
If it isn't music or if it isn't speech, anything else is a sound effects man. That is, from the simple thing of opening and closing doors to opening and closing wars.
Well, what did you do when the Lone Ranger went galloping off into the distance?
When the Lone Ranger went galloping off, why, we'd have coconut shells. And you take these hooves. Now, I'll do it on my chest now, and you would fade the horse away. It'd be like this.
And fire?
Fire, we'd take in cellophane and you just crinkle it very slowly, and it gives you a... You don't have a pack of cigarettes, do you? Here, let me show. They just take and crinkle that cellophane very slowly on the mic.
Bob Prescott, what have been some of the most difficult sounds that you've had to produce?
One of the most unusual requests, this car was going along with the kids singing merrily, and they skidded off and went down this embankment. And the director said, now, Bob, he said, I want a noisy silence.
A noisy silence.
And I finally figured out, I thought what he wanted, and the car came along, and the kids were singing merrily, and then they screamed, and they went over this terrible crash, over the embankment, and everything was quiet, and then all of a sudden, just out of nowhere, why, you heard a little sound like this. In other words, crickets. I'm doing it with my comb now.
Oh, I know. It's right here in the hall closet.
I hate smelling
no,
rice,
it won't
McGee.
Take a minute. I know. Right.
Fibber, McGee, and Molly were as real as real-life people who were also radio stars. Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby, Jack Benny, Ed Wynn, Easy Aces, Milton Berle, Arthur Godfrey, Phil Spitalny and his all-girl orchestra, and who could forget...
Hi, it's time for the Abbott and Costello Show. We're on the air for ABC here in Hollywood.
Well, what are we waiting for? Let's go with the Abbott and Costello Show.
Crime does not pay. The Great Gildersleeve.
Raymond Page and the Canteen Orchestra. Stand by.
Dr. I.Q. Thank you, Mr. Lennon.
Dance music programs pioneered by the likes of Guy Lombardo, Harry Horlick's A&P Gypsies, and Glenn Miller remained popular attractions through the late 40s.
Glenn Miller and his famous orchestra.
playing in the smart, spacious setting of the Cafe Rouge of the Hotel Pennsylvania, the Statler Hotel in New York City.
But already the nature of radio was changing. A handful of stations in key cities were successful with formats which did away with soap operas and traditional forms of radio programming. Commercials, a little talk, and records spun by a fellow called a disc jockey. Just as Americans had been fascinated by the sounds which a cat whisker radio set could pull out of the air, they'd soon become fascinated by the images which could be reproduced on the face of a cathode ray tube. Radio, especially network radio, would suffer at the hands of television. But radio would soon be reborn in the form of the transistor. It was the radio which you could carry around in your pocket. It was the transistor radio which would keep you informed when the power failed. It was the radio which would be flexible enough to bring you the whole story in time of national emergency or when a rocket blasted skyward.
There is still no official word here at Parkland Memorial Hospital on the condition of President Kennedy. Mr. Kennedy has now been in the emergency ward of the hospital.
27 after 5. Total darkness. No electricity. No communication.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The real-life drama of news in the making has replaced the prose of the dramatists as the key element of radio broadcasting today.
And there goes the siren.
Where is the caisson?
No one is moving.
The deeds that have come about so far.
The entire citizenry, the nation.
Peace and justice and freedom.
This is a sad time for all people.
Let the word go forth from this time and place.
As long as there are things going on in the world which people must know about, there will be a need for radio. In some communities, there are radio stations which broadcast nothing but news all day. And radio became two-way with telephone talk shows. And there's a new world of FM listening, bringing concert hall stereophonic sound right into the home. FM now has been adopted as the stepchild of the now generation. Some FM stations are filled with the now sounds of acid rock. Pretty hard to find a car these days which doesn't have a radio. And more cars have radios which can receive AM and FM. Radio is undergoing a rebirth as a sales medium, as America's advertisers seek surer ways to reach this mobile population of ours. Radio has adapted to the changing times. Radio has chronicled some of man's greatest moments in its first 50 years. Radio will continue to do so in its next 50 years, and radio will be there at the population's fingertips to inform, educate, and entertain whenever people want, wherever they are. This is Don Gardner, ABC Radio News, New York.
Return to Studio 1A, a special program to mark the 50th anniversary of broadcasting, was produced by Peter Katz. Executive producer Tom O'Brien, directed by Bill Gately. Engineering by Neil Pulse. Special effects by Walton Dell. This is Charles Wood speaking. This has been a special report from ABC Radio News.